and we're delighted that you could join the CER seminar series. Francesco Cipelli apparently has fallen in love with UCLA. I mean, what I understand is you were a medical student in Bologna, and you came here just for a brief sojourn.
Exactly.
A brief sojourn, changed everything, decided to be an undergraduate here, get a master's degree here, get a PhD here, get on the faculty in medicine and on the faculty in dentistry, and
stayed here.
And stayed here? Yes,
stayed here.
Yes, I
stayed
wanted to.
Stayed here temporarily. When do I go back to Tuscany?
And has a very interesting background. He was actually a systems biologist and is involved in mind-body interactions. Immune functioning, many things that I didn't even know about your background, cellular immune resistance, but I did know about this book, Evidence-Based Practice Towards Optimizing Clinical Outcomes, and thought this was a perfect fit for what we want to do in this seminar series, and that is talk about methods, approaches, research, and how we move forward with comparative effectiveness research. So we're looking forward to you sharing whatever you'd like to share.
Great. Thank you, Lenore. Thank you, Ron, for organizing this, this seminar and for allowing me to come here and share my thoughts and some of our work on this topic of clinically relevant complex systematic reviews. We'll have to investigate or understand exactly what we mean by that. And what are the next challenges in comparative effectiveness research and analysis? First, let's look at what comparative effectiveness research is. And as it was defined by the Institute of Medicine in 2009, a couple of years ago, it is essentially the generation and synthesis of evidence that compares the benefit and harms of alternative methods to prevent, diagnose, treat, and monitor clinical conditions and clinical outcomes, and to improve the delivery of care. So there are several important concepts here. It is the synthesis of evidence that compares two or more alternative ways of delivering care to prevent, diagnose, and treat conditions in order to improve the delivery of care. The purpose of this is to assist the consumers, the clinicians, the patients, the policymakers to make informed decisions. That is really the crux of what we're trying to do, is to help the clinicians and the patients to increase health literacy so that better and more informed decisions are made. And these are, I believe, the two principal challenges of comparative effectiveness research and analysis for the next decade. That is, how do we really generate and synthesize the evidence correctly? And how do we guide then the clinicians and the patients and the policymakers to make a better informed decision for the purpose of improving treatment? This is not a new field. It is a field that has becoming more and more established over the last decade or so. And the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality has had a portfolio of research and funding in that domain, where you see that comparative effectiveness research was about one-fifth and has been about one-fifth of their portfolio in the past few years. Now, in comparative effectiveness research, as we just said, the AHRQ funds research synthesis. And the product of the research synthesis is what we call systematic review. I know some of you have looked at some of the things I've written, and perhaps some of these thoughts that maybe you have been reading relate to the fact that it is our belief that the term systematic review is a misnomer. It is an unfortunate misnomer at this point because it has been established and used for the last 10 years and probably will be for the next few decades. But it is a misnomer because, as we will see in what we talk about today, the process of research synthesis is a systematic science. It is a systematic approach to research. It follows the scientific process as all science, molecular biology, immunology, cell biology, what have you. So the fact of calling it systematic review, the fact of emphasizing the word systematic, would then suggest or imply that any other type of research is not systematic. And for some reason, it might have some systematic approach that other sciences don't have.
Can I ask you something about that? Because
yeah.
I mean, I thought the reason would be that you could have reviews that are not systematic.
You can have your reviews that are not systematic. You can have literature reviews, narrative reviews, and that is the other reason why this is a misnomer. The term review is inappropriate, because what we really produce when we produce a report on research synthesis is a research report. It is not a narrative review. So it is inappropriate, really, to call it systematic review, but it is unfortunate the field has been calling it that way, and I think we're pretty much stuck with it. For the last 3 or 4 years, you see here that the AHRQ has been the second largest funding source for research in CER, NIH being the most generous source of funds. And you also see that roughly 86% of the CER studies across the agencies were focusing on disease conditions and special patient populations. And you will see by the end of our discussion today how this might be evolving and changing a little bit for the next decade. Now then, what is the process of generating and synthesizing research evidence? How is it that the AHRQ and the Institute of Medicine want us to approach this field? Research synthesis is, as we see here, the synthesis of all of the research evidence, all of the available research evidence that pertains to a given patient population. So that it goes through a systematic process of search of all of the literature, inclusion-exclusion criteria, an assessment of the level of the evidence, of the quality of the evidence, analyses, statistical analyses, inference to generate a conclusion which in this particular field we call a consensus statement. This consensus statement is really what we are looking for. We are looking for the best available evidence. And this is what the research synthesis produces. It is, as I said before, generally presented as a systematic review, which may or may not include a meta-analysis. So if we were to begin to evaluate the quality of systematic reviews, we would say that those that have, in fact, statistical analysis, including a meta-analysis, would be preferred over those systematic reviews that are not allowing a quantitative assessment of the research evidence and the meta-analysis. So we will be examining some of these features as we proceed. And I would like to proceed today looking at these three major points. Systematic reviews, what are they, and how do we go from systematic reviews to clinically relevant, complex systematic reviews? Then I would like to see how we can use systematic reviews and complex, clinically relevant complex systematic review in effectiveness versus efficacy decision making. And then we'll have to examine how that fits into the agenda of CER research in the next decade as funds have become or are becoming more available. So I don't think I have to remind any of you in this room the process of the systematic review or the process of research synthesis, but let's go through it very quickly. It will start from a patient, from the patient who is seen by the physician or the dentist or the nurse, and who expresses and presents certain complaints, signs, or symptoms. Those complaints, signs, symptoms for that particular patient are translated into a research question. A research question which we call PICO question. The P stands for patient population, the I for the interventions that we might want to compare for a given clinical outcome. When we do CER, we also want to incorporate the notion of time and the settings. So it becomes a PCOTS question. But whether it is a PICO question or PCOTS question, the point is that we take what the patient says and what the patient presents and all of the medical and dental history and all of the lab results that we might have to define the patient and determine what intervention we might want to compare, we might want to try, we might want to do on this particular patient for a given outcome. The given outcome could be the increased quality of life or what have you, the resolution of a disease, the decrease of inflammation, what have you. That answerable question generates the keywords, the mesh words for the search. And we will do a search not only on PubMed, but we will include a number of databases. We will include published research, peer-reviewed research. It's often gray literature, that is literature that is not peer-reviewed, that such as proceedings of meetings, dissertations and theses and such things. We will try to obtain all of the available evidence. That is the point of this step, is to obtain all of the available evidence and to synthesize it. This is where the research synthesis process occurs. So that out of this synthesis, we will obtain the best available evidence. So we will have to dissect out how do we obtain the best? What is the best? That process is then presented to the scientific world as the systematic review. For the clinician, it is translated into the consensus statement, into revised clinical practice guidelines, which are then integrated either in a comparative effectiveness analysis or research, or in an evidence-based practice arm of the research, and we will see how that is done, and the treatment policy, new treatment policies may be developed based on these revised clinical practice guidelines. Now, out of that model, how do I go back? There. Out of that model, as I said, the most problematic issue is how to determine what is the best available evidence. In science, we like to be quantitative. We do not like to be qualitative. Sometimes we can only describe, but we like to estimate. So one approach has been to estimate the level of the evidence, that is, the level of what was done. Was it a clinical trial? Was it an observational study? Was it a randomized controlled trial, or was it a non-randomized trial or non-controlled trial? Was it a case-controlled study? Was it a basic research, an animal study? So some kind of a hierarchy was established in the field and grew over the last decade or so. That hierarchy is viewed differently in the UK or in the US and numbered slightly differently, but it is still a hierarchy. It is not an assessment, a quantitative assessment. It is more of a qualitative assessment, a qualitative answer to the question, what was done? So the level of evidence is not really informative. It is as if to say, well, Ron, what do we have for lunch today? Chicken. Well, we could have a lasagna, but we had chicken. The other question is, how was it done? Well, is the chicken burnt? Was it well cooked or is it raw? Is the lasagna absolutely uneatable, or is it, you know, like an Italo-American type lasagna, or is it like a Bolognese type lasagna? The question is not so much what was done, it is how it was done. And we all know the standards of good research methodology, design, and data analysis. We all can recognize when a t-test was wrongly used, and the authors should have used an ANOVA, for example. We all recognize that because that is very simple research methods classes that we take as undergraduates and we continue to develop as scientists. So the level of the evidence produces simply a qualitative perspective on the research that is presented to us. The quality of the evidence can be quantified And it can be quantified by a number of instruments that are arising more and more in the literature. We developed the Wang, Jason Wang was a student in my group, and eventually we revised the Wang. Jason Kung took the AmpStar that was developed by Xie and revised it. Recently, the Grade is an instrument that we are all familiar with, and Linda in my group has now produced an expanded version of the Grade. And we will be looking at some of these instruments as the slides continue. But these instruments are simply examples. I am not saying that they are the only ones available or the best ones available. They are the ones that we happen to use in our research. Why? Because the Wang, for example, provides a nice quantitative measurements of methodology, design, and data analysis. Many of these quantitative instruments to assess the quality of the evidence that you find in the literature, you will find primarily an examination of the design, for example, the consort and the JADAD scale, or an assessment of the design and the methodology. But very seldom do you find an instrument that will also be asking specific questions about the data analysis and how the data analysis, the statistics, were done. The revised AmpStar, if you look at the instrument, is actually a very strong instrument that is a product of a factor analysis of multiple items and multiple instruments. Xie did an excellent job, except that in the last step of his processing the AmpStar, he generated questions that sound something like this. For question one, the answers might be yes, no, not applicable, cannot tell. And question two, the same type of choice of answer. So how do you score? How do you give a number to a yes, no, cannot tell, or maybe it's there but I cannot find it? So that was Jason's contribution here to actually transform that, and based on criteria, to make it a quantitative instrument. And you will see what we did with the X-Grade. But the point of this slide is to say that, yes, we have the level of evidence, but we somehow have to move into a more standardized process by which we establish and quantify the quality of the evidence. For example, here we have the revised AmpStar, the 11 question of the AmpStar. We have 5 reports, it doesn't matter on what. You have multiple readers, so what you see here are the means of multiple readers. We establish inter-rater reliability and Kuhn Kappa levels of agreement among the readers. And for each one of the reports, you obtain a total score. And it's quite evident that some papers score higher than other papers. So now you have a number, and that number begins to tell you something in terms of the quality of that particular systematic review versus this particular systematic review, for example. You can also look at the individual questions, and you will see questions with a mean of 1.3 versus questions with a mean of 3.9. It tells you something about the strength of that particular domain that is addressed by question 11 or question 4 across the systematic reviews that are there, that are available. You also can look at the standard deviations, and it tells you how tightly together those inferences can be. For example, here you have a standard deviation of 0.27 versus a standard deviation of 1.2. It tells you that one is relatively close, the other is relatively spread, which indicates that here you have outliers, you have a great deal of variability among the systematic reviews for these particular questions, versus here you have a certain degree of homogeneity. And homogeneity becomes a very important topic as we synthesize the literature.
Sorry, I didn't quite follow that. Is this a way, I mean, a lot of the grading systems, like you said, assess the designs and to some extent the execution of the design.
Right.
This seems to be talking about the external validity in the sense of, is this suitable for this patient here that I'm looking at rather than those that went through the trial. Have I understood this right? When you say homogeneity, are you talking about whether it was a specific sample of patients that went through the trial, or how broad the sample of patients were that went through the trial?
This is a very good question. In this particular acceptable sampling analysis, we are looking at systematic reviews. We are looking at systematic review number one through five.
Reviews.
Those are systematic reviews.
Yeah. Okay.
And we're looking at, and I don't remember exactly the topic of question 11 or question 10, we're looking at how homogeneous the five papers are with respect to being strong or weak in that particular domain that is examined by question 11.
Yeah.
Okay. And the point I'm trying to make is that as we generate numbers, as we quantify, we can begin to do nice statistical analyses and acceptable sampling analyses of these reports, which then can be translated in a clinician-friendly manner. Because here we have another set of studies. These systematic reviews were on PTSD. We have, again, 11 papers. We have the results, the scores of the totals of the revised NAMSTAR corresponding to these totals. These can be translated to a percentile, and the percentile can be translated to a grade, the same way as we translate our students' results into a grade.
Sorry, my question was really about something really simple. The usual criticism is, I'm, say, a primary care physician. This patient is very different to those that the trial was done. How I have to try and figure out or guess whether the same results will occur with this patient to those that were in the trial.
Yes.
And this patient has, you know, maybe they don't have any other conditions, but then if they've got multiple morbidity, you know, then I say, well, actually the trial's pretty irrelevant for this patient. That doesn't really address the difference between my patients and the trial patients.
That is not addressing it yet. You
okay,
will see
right.
how we'll come back
yeah.
to it. If I fail to answer your question in a few minutes, then remind me of your question.
Yeah.
Okay, this is really where CER and evidence-based, where effectiveness and efficacy separate.
That's right.
Okay?
Maybe I missed something, but how does having something be the best evidence make it the best treatment for a particular patient? For example, in a lot of fields, there's no good evidence, or there's very limited evidence, and so you're going to end up with a lot of things that are a B or a C, and you might maybe have one thing that has great evidence, but its effect size is pretty small, and, you know, some poor evidence that suggests a much bigger effect size or a much more better compatibility with the patient's value. So it seems like just because the studies were good doesn't mean that it's necessarily the best available treatment for a particular patient.
That is a very good point also. Not every condition can be addressed by CER or evidence-based approaches. Not every condition will lend itself to this type of research synthesis. Okay? That's point number one. Point number two, if you remember, we start from the patient and we define the question, we define this search, we define these five papers based on a characterization of the patient. The PICO question, how the PICO question is stated, is extremely important. Because on this particular domain of PTSD, you will have much more than just 11 systematic reviews available. But these 11 reflected specifically the patient described in the PICO question. So here, out of these 11, we will find a few papers that are acceptable, that are good, that could be considered by the clinician as the best available evidence. Now then the clinician would then approach the patient and say, well, I have looked at your medical history, I have looked at your lab tests, I have looked at the best available evidence pertaining specifically to your case. And my clinical decision, my clinical recommendation is as follows. It goes back on the shoulders of the clinician and on the clinical expertise of the clinician to make the best decision. And I will, in my second part, I will talk about how this best decision is attained. It is not based on numbers, it is not based on probabilities anymore. It is based essentially on clinical judgment. Okay? Yes?
This is another basic question. I thought I just heard you say systematic reviews 1 through 11 or whatever, but are those individual papers that are being evaluated?
Yes, these are individual papers. These are individual systematic
reviews. Part of the systematic review process is to evaluate each of the individual papers?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So because what you have in the situation that you find yourself in the literature now is that for several clinical conditions or clinical situations, there are several systematic reviews available. So we have to elevate our science one step and say, okay, we were first looking at primary research and doing systematic reviews. Now we have to do what has been called in the literature complex systematic reviews, that is, a systematic reviews of several systematic reviews. And this is what the AMSTAR was designed to do, to assess the quality of individual systematic reviews so that then they could be put together. Yes?
Because it's too much effort to go back and do it the way you think is the best.
Right, because if you were to take all the paper, if you were to design a PICO question and find, let's say, 5 systematic reviews, you would not want to have to go through the primary research in each one of those 5 and recombine it. Mm-hmm. What you want to be able to do is to have a system whereby you can take that those systematic reviews, those research reports, and put them together at a higher level of complexity. Mm-hmm. And that's where the term complex systematic review has arisen.
There's going to be a lot of overlap in the evidence that each of these is lifting up.
Yes, mm-hmm. Sometimes.
So does the time frame have to be the same, or it could be at different times?
That is where the notion of homogeneity among the systematic review arises. And the term clinically relevant complex systematic review addresses your very point. This is not just a statistical exercise. This is a process by which we obtain a complex systematic review that is actually usable clinically by the physician or the dentist.
Yeah, but in that one issue, though, if you have completely not overlapping time intervals, then sort of the sum is sort of the whole history versus some are overlapping and others aren't. Do you take that into account?
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So essentially, the systematic review is the process to obtain the best available evidence, primarily from clinical trial. However, one challenge that we have is to open this up so that we begin to be able to use observational studies and possibly fundamental research studies, basic science studies. There is already a process by which we can incorporate observational studies, and that is actually very useful because in many instances, particularly in dentistry actually, we cannot have a clinical trial. We just have situations in dentistry where the patients cannot be blinded. They either have an implant or they don't. There's just no way that you can blind the patient to the intervention. So most of the, a large percentage of the studies in dentistry are actually of the observational type, which then is a problem if you only look at the level of the evidence, because the level of the evidence for an observational study is level 2 and below, 2 and 3. So right away, you would say that the best available evidence in dentistry is very weak. Well, no, it is not very weak. It is simply that the field calls for observational studies. Now, there will also be a drive to establish some kind of a translational arm to evidence-based research and comparative effectiveness research. And in that sense, we will have to find a way to integrate the basic science and the fundamental research, so that the systematic review and this acceptable sampling process becomes a product of the research synthesis from all available type designs in the health sciences. And these, as I said, sometimes incorporate meta-analysis. We're not going to be talking about meta-analysis. Maybe I'll come back another time and talk about meta-analysis. Sometimes we incorporate meta-analysis, but in every instance, we seek to obtain the best available evidence for the patient. So this is the step I was talking about. Up to now, we were here. We were producing primary research reports. We were doing research synthesis and generating systematic reviews. That for the purpose of obtaining a consensus statement of the best available evidence and possibly revising the clinical practice guidelines. Now we have situations where we have several systematic reviews, and each might have a consensus statement, and somehow we have to find a way to put them together into a complex systematic review that is clinically relevant. That is where we need to go. Because we need to move somehow from evidence-based research to evidence-based clinical practice and to evidence-based decision-making without ever losing track or losing perspective on the patient needs, the patient wants, the clinical experience and expertise, and of course the costs. So then the question is, how do we make those decisions, and how do we distinguish effectiveness from efficacy? So the Federal Coordinated Council on Comparative Effectiveness Research has been kind enough to define for us the differences between comparative effectiveness research as seeking, as addressing the real-world needs and decision faced by patients, clinicians, and decision-makers, generally including assessments of risk, costs, and benefits. Whereas efficacy is a question that is typically addressed by the clinician. Does this work? Does this treatment work? Will it work for this particular patient? Will this best available evidence really be pertinent to this particular patient? And I believe I'm addressing your question and your question at this point. This is the difference between efficacy and effectiveness. When we do comparative effectiveness research, essentially we stay in this domain. When we talk about risks, costs, and benefits, of course they address the patients. But in a sense, they don't address the health of the patient. When we talk about efficacy, of course we talk about the patient, but we're addressing the clinical problem of the patient. Of course we're concerned about costs and benefits and risks, but we're really more concerned about resolving the physiopathology and bringing the patient back into a normal physiology, a homeostasis type domain. So comparative effectiveness research is often described as generalizable. And here I believe I address your question. external validity type question. When we talk about efficacy, we talk specifically about the implications for the patient. And the results, the outcome might not be generalizable. In fact, they are not. They are directed to the patient. And if you remember the process started from the patient. So somehow we start the process from the patient, and here we come back to the patient. Whereas here we start from the patient, and we come back to general questions or general issues about risk of that those particular treatment intervention, costs and benefits.
I am struck by something. I mean, they do say science is about making generalizations.
Yes.
But yet the designs for maximum certainty about efficacy have been privileged as being, you know, the height of the triangle. But it's saying here that they, and on reflection, I suppose one would agree that actually they don't produce, or it's not necessarily generalizable. So how is it that the randomized controlled trial has become the epitome of science? Given that it doesn't,
this is more a philosophy of question, a philosophy of science question.
Necessarily provide generalizable knowledge. It's just a sudden paradox.
I think we need to go back to
brought out by that
to Sir Fisher and the statistics, the development of the experimental design in the 1920s.
That actually, it's effectiveness research that is the much more scientific, and therefore designs and approaches.
How do you define scientific?
Well, if you use that criteria about generalizable.
I think you can say that the effectiveness research is more statistical in nature. In fact, the decision-making process is based on statistics. This is the much more human interaction, dyad, clinician-patient decision process. This is what the clinician takes all of this information into his or her mind and logically comes to what needs to be done for the patient, based on the clinical expertise, based on the patient history, based on the best available evidence. That doesn't make it less scientific. It makes it less quantifiable. It makes it less statistical in nature. And that is really the distinction between the two decision models. So I don't know, perhaps we're defining scientific in different
ways.
No,
I'm sorry, I was shooting off in another direction. You do carry on.
Okay, let me continue on that. I think I hope I will clarify that.
Unfair interjection.
Yes,
isn't it just a matter of it's easier to make an inference about something in a very limited way in a clinical trial because you've controlled for everything?
Yeah.
I mean, that's all the big benefit is from that, whereas then you can't generalize beyond that specific circumstance. That's
well, yes, but then you have, I mean, now you're entering into the domain of internal validity, external validity issues of the clinical trial and how the sample was obtained, the sampling process, and how it was randomized, the random allocation. And so before we go to that final statement, there are a number of things we have to do to build that bridge. It's not just a de facto that when we have a clinical trial, we have a perfectly generalizable outcome. We don't. Very often we have actually a very weak.
No, that's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry.
You're saying in a very special circumstance, you have a good basis for inferring under that very limited circumstance what's going on because everything's controlled. But it's not generalizable,
right.
Generally.
Right, exactly. That's the internal external validity issue.
Yeah.
So this is a dyad that we proposed a couple of years ago where we put comparative effectiveness research and comparative efficacy research on two sides of the same coin, putting research synthesis and the systematic review right in the middle. And it starts from the PICO question. It goes through the same process, but it really depends what you are looking for. If you're looking for effectiveness, risk, benefit, cost issues, or if you're looking for efficacy of treatment. If you're looking to do a cost-effective type decision, or if you're looking for an individualized patient care type decision. Now, AHRQ presents essentially the same model, and I'm very glad about that, where they have comparative effectiveness research, and they call it evidence-based efficacy research. That's fine with me. They start with a clinical encounter, which is what we were talking about. It goes through research synthesis. The research synthesis report, either the systematic review or what we're talking about today, the clinically relevant complex systematic reviews, and they feed into the decision-making process, which in the effectiveness model is this Markovian tree utility model, probability-based decision process. And in the patient-centered efficacy design or model is this logic-based approach to decision-making. So I'm pretty sure that we are all familiar with probabilities and how the Markovian tree is built. So I don't have any slides on that, but I brought a slide of the logic model so that you can see how it proceeds. So the clinician would have inputs from the patients, clinical information, medical history, X-rays. Of course, the clinician would listen to the patient needs, the wants. The clinician would be aware of the costs and the benefits. priority of coverage and so forth, and the clinician would have, of course, clinical judgment and clinical expertise. All of that fits into the box of input in this logic model. the best available evidence, which is produced by the process we were describing, also fits into the inputs. So that then interventions are coming to the mind and carried out by the clinician. Of course, these activities, those interventions, will lead to output. The output will be evaluated by the clinician. And if, in fact, the outputs are satisfactory, those will have to become, perhaps, long-lasted impacts, policies. And along the way, we have, in this logic model, instruments and processes by which we can obtain formative and summative evaluation. So I mentioned the Jadad and the Wong, and the Sort and Agree are other instruments that help us to evaluate the best available evidence. When we are at the level of systematic reviews, we use the AMSTAR, the Quorum for meta-analysis. More recently, we have the revised AMSTAR. Liberati and Moore just presented the PRISMA, which is an evolution of the Quorum. To evaluate the output, we obtain that using the GRADE. And as I said, we are working on an expanded version of the GRADE. And the GRADE provides you an additional notion not only of quality of the clinical evidence, but the strength of the clinical recommendation. We'll look at how that works at this point. So the extended grade or expanded grade is an extension of this grading of recommendation assessment, development, and evaluation that was originally published by Clouzeau and her group. It has two levels. One that assesses the quality of the evidence so that the clinical trials or the systematic reviews that are unacceptable are eliminated. It can be obtained either with the revised Wong or another instrument if you're looking at primary sources, or the AMSTAR or the revised AMSTAR if you're assessing systematic reviews in the manner we discussed. And that will then focus on the second part of the X grade, or second part of the grade, original grade, which looks at the strength of the recommendation. Again, we have translated this into a quantifiable instrument so that now we have domains of weak strength, uncertain strength, or strong strength of clinical recommendation. And so now we could have systematic reviews or clinical trials that emerge from this available evidence as the best, not only in terms of quality of evidence, but in terms of the strength of the quality, of the strength of the clinical recommendation. And again, this is a translation of this process into an easy-to-use table where we have four systematic reviews, I believe they were in this case. We obtain a score, we translate this score into percentile, we rank the paper, and then we provide the clinician with the best available evidence. And it is up to the clinician then to utilize or not utilize this best available evidence for that particular patient. Now, in the next few minutes, I would like to simply look very broadly as in terms of what is the next agenda for our research, our CER research, or efficacy, effectiveness research in the next decade. What is available? What is becoming available? Until today, AHRQ had received $129 million from Congress for comparative effectiveness research. In 2009, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act dedicated $1.1 billion for comparative effectiveness research. So there is a big train about to leave the station. The recommendations for the portfolio for this research in comparative effectiveness research actually fall into four domains. One is the data infrastructure, not only databases, but also HIT. Number two, dissemination and translation. How do we best disseminate? How do we best increase the health literacy? How do we best make our colleagues aware of what comparative effectiveness research is, of what comparative efficacy research is? How do we best train the clinician to use comparative efficacy research? and our policy decision makers how to use comparative effectiveness research. How do we communicate to insurance companies? This is the best available treatment. This is what you should really cover. In dentistry, we have several situations where most dentists would know that this treatment is preferable to that treatment, but the insurance simply will not cover it. The third domain of research that that is recommended is continuing to compare priority patient groups, patients with diabetes, patients with cardiovascular disease, patients with cancer, women's health, and so forth. These patients' groups that have, in the last decade, been traditionally addressed, we need to continue to look at them, and we need to continue to look at specific interventions for specific problems, HIV and AIDS, and so forth. And number four, how do we improve the methods? How do we do comparative effectiveness research better? How do we do comparative efficacy research better? And how do we train the next generation? These are really what the Federal Council wants us to address because, and this is a quote from them, in doing so, we will empower doctors and patients and help our practice of medicine to become more evidence-based. The priority one, in terms of the methodology, we need for a broad federal CER enterprise. In other words, we need to expand this spider web, if you will, of CER across our universities so that we then are able to cut across treatments, preventions, patient populations, health determinant interventions, and so forth. We need to enhance information principles and tools to prioritize CER so that we change the practice, so that we improve the practice, so that we improve medical treatment and dental treatment. We need the funding so that we enhance and extend our research, not only locally, but also in multi-center type domain. And I would venture to say not only nationally, but also globally. We need to develop this science of CER, and I just love this. When you have somebody in Washington who comes up with the science of what we're working on, that gets me really happy. Now it has been elevated to the level of a science. So now, to go back to the AHRQ and what we were talking about, we have this model, and I propose that this model needs to be enhanced by and expanded by including this branch into translational research. We need to be able, for example, to follow a particular patient. We have a situation, for example, in dentistry, which is called oral lichen planus. Oral lichen planus is a lesion of the soft mucosa. Mostly women after menopause get this lesion. When they have it, they keep it basically for life. It's not like lichen planus on the skin. In the mouth, it stays. It behaves like an autoimmune, it waxes and wanes. In the most aggressive lesions, the erosive lesions, have a very high propensity to turn into oral carcinoma. So it is actually a very dangerous thing that we need to address in terms of women health and in terms of oral biology and medicine. Now what we need to be able to do is to take a biopsy, for example, from these lesions so that we can do some proteomics. And we can identify the particular immune cell population that has invaded the lesion at that particular moment. We can identify the particular signaling process that is going on in that particular lesion, in that particular woman. So that if then we have already established, as we have, our paper has been out now for several months, if we have established the signature of these lesions when they become oral carcinoma, then we can intervene on that particular patient because now we can see, well before the clinician is able to determine that that lesion is turning to carcinoma, we can see it at the molecular level, we can see it at the proteomic level, that that particular patient has a lesion that is turning to oral carcinoma. And if we do evidence-based research and comparative effectiveness research and we have determined what is the best available treatment, the best available method to block that particular pathway. Then we can intervene on that patient, specifically on that patient. Now the thing is, those type of studies, that is the studies that will identify how to block a particular signaling pathway, those are studies that are done in cell culture and animal studies. And that is why I showed you that slide early on, where I said the fundamental research needs to be dragged into our research synthesis process when we think of it from a translational perspective. And this is essentially, I just summarized the work of my PhD students who defended his PhD last June. Now, I also believe that, as I said before, we need to extend our CER, comparative effectiveness and comparative efficacy research, globally. We cannot be provincial. We need to realize the fact that across the world, people are talking about evidence-based medicine, evidence-based dentistry, comparative effectiveness research. I collaborate with people in Brazil, I collaborate with people in India, I collaborate with people in Europe. This is definitely the future of healthcare, a global perspective. If we look, for example, at the Gates Foundation, which traditionally is very generous in funding for global projects, they have, in the last couple of years, extended the range of their interest into HIT and evidence-based type research and comparative effectiveness type research. So the question I would like to leave you is this one. Where is the place of UCLA in all of this? We need to somehow get into the driver's seat. We are not presently. We need to somehow get there. So I just want to thank Dr. Ajay from Saudi Arabia, Dr. Bao, you will meet this afternoon, Dr. Brandt from Brazil, Dr. Cahulis from the Philippines, Dr. Kong, I mentioned his work, Dr. Neagos from Romania, Dr. Oluwadara from Nigeria, Dr. Ramchandani from India, Dr. Wong, I indicated his name. And I want to emphasize the work of my students, particularly the pre-dental and the pre-medical students, who are absolutely fantastic, and especially Linda, who has done the work on the expanded or extended grade. So now, enjoy the chicken.
Yeah. I just wondered, since the last thing you said, what about dentistry and how does that fit for CER? I don't know. You know, they have like top list of things to go after. Is there some specific dentistry related issues that you're trying to pursue to try to get funding for in CER funding?
Yes, actually, we are awaiting funding. I think that it's going to come in the next few days to do a comparative effectiveness project in how to make dental practices more sustainable. One thing that I wrote last year, I think, or this year, was sustainable evidence-based decision-making, trying to bring this whole domain into how to make healthcare more sustainable. We are addressing issues of the relationship between oral biology and medicine and medicine. For example, with Dr. Ramchandani, we are looking at the issue of oral health and periodontal disease in the health of the pregnant woman and of the baby. And what is the best available evidence and what is the best intervention that we can then propose in countries with emerging societies. I forget now what is the politically correct way of describing. We are doing some interesting work, continuing some interesting work, bringing it into the CER EBD domain on HIV and AIDS. And I mentioned before the work on osteoimmunology, evidence-based osteoimmunology, the interaction between the bone and the immune system, which can be very briefly describe as why do you have bone degradation when you have arthritis, which is an inflammatory disease. Yes?
Yes, your question about a place for UCLA. I speak in ignorance, having only, this is actually my first day at UCLA.
Well, welcome.
Only my second day over here. The first day was over at the VA implementation research. Now my field is management, implementation, changing health systems, changing provider behavior. And one of the questions is just UCLA or USCLA in partnerships with VA researchers, possibly even RAND researchers, putting together consortium. Because I think there's a whole set of issues which is to do with implementation and putting the ideas into practice through guideline implementation or a whole variety of different change methods. And RAND and the VA Implementation Center are very good on that part of the puzzle. So it struck me that there may be a possibility for a distinctive pitch by UCLA and partners to be covering the whole spectrum, because you've very well described a much broader view of or way of looking at it, and in particular bringing in the basic sciences. So I would say also add at the later stages, which is the implementation, putting it into practice in ordinary health systems, ways of thinking and studies, and what is effective for doing that. So you might be able to put in a kind of a combined bid with all of those partners to be studying the whole continuum and to do it in phases by picking out a particular condition or patient group. I mean, for example, you was it PTSD that you flagged up there? Now, PTSD, at the far end downstream, neurosciences, positron emission technology, are there brain changes in people with PTSD of interest to the veterans people? Doing the reviews like you've done in this way that you've done, and then saying, well, okay, if we can put together a package of recommended, which is to do efficacy and effectiveness, and then the later bits about, yes, and how do we put this into practice more quickly so that more physicians are using this knowledge more often with their patients using the implementation science. You've then got the broad spectrum of approaches for a particular condition. So that's one way, as it were, to put in a bid or to put in this.
I think that's an excellent suggestion.
That's an outsider's reaction, but I'm also interested, I mean, you've been here, what did you say, 30 years?
I'm old. I'm getting older, but not that old.
You can see the range of approaches that UCLA has.
Yes, no, definitely.
Where do you think are there groups that potentially could be put together, or are there areas where particular parts of this that UCLA is particularly strong in?
Well, definitely, they are.
Supposing I'm
there are domains in UCLA.
What's your recommendation to me for what we should pitch in for? Well, if you stuck your neck out, what would you say?
I think the very first step I would suggest is exactly what we are doing this afternoon. That is to establish a dialogue between nursing, dentistry, and medicine. I should have said medicine first. medicine, nursing,
we're not
and dentistry.
I
think that's the very first step. I think there are other domains also that are becoming quite allied to this research synthesis process in healthcare. We can think of psychopathology, we can think of information technology, we can think of business and administration. There are a number of things that are available at UCLA and will become part of the network. Certainly, UCLA already has an excellent relationship with RAND and the VA, so that is definitely a natural. And vertically, UCLA is part of the UC, So we cannot forget UC San Diego, UCSF, and both in terms of dental school, nursing school, and medical school. And so there is, you know, a California task force, if you will, of comparative effectiveness / efficacy that could be developed. At that same time, each one of us involved in that task force, if it's called task force, has already existing relationships. Former students that we formed, colleagues, co-authors all over the world. So that UCLA-born extended network becomes actually an international collaborative effort, which then almost naturally will combine and congeal with the Cochrane group, which is, as we all know, the international essence of comparative effectiveness and evidence-based research. So, and there are representations of the Cochrane group in just about every country in the world, including Brazil, the Philippines, Switzerland, Italy, and so forth. And then in individual countries, there are their own, or maybe it's only in Italy, but we have the Cochrane Italia, but we also have our own, you know, group of evidence-based medicine research. I don't know, maybe Italians are like that. They like to do things their way. But somehow these groups need to be connected so that now we form a network that is geared at, I believe, three principal goals. Number one, increase the health literacy and the well-being of the patient. That is really the center. Number two, assist the clinician in making the best possible decision for interventions for each individual patient. When possible, when it is possible to in fact use the best available research. And number three, to make these treatments coverable by insurance and affordable by patients. So there is a cost issue that definitely we need to work with the insurance companies, and we need to work with the clinicians, and we need to work for the patients. But it's a very complex problem, and I think each one of us can really only scratch the surface on one particular angle, but somehow we need to have a clear vision, something like what you were saying, a vision of what we do for, you know, for the entire range of perspectives. And that's, so my question, a place for UCLA, was a place for UCLA at the heart, in the driver's seat of this movement.
I think it's an important question, what's our niche? And, you know, we'll need to be feeling across the talent pool to see what it is. I've heard a lot that health service research underserved populations, a lot of skill sets and methodological developments there. What we certainly have that we think no one else has is this unique population. You know, we have just incredible diversity in the needs of, you know, and the ethnic variability in our backyard that no one else has, and a concentration of resources in terms of the institution here, our health insurances, RAND, and other institutions. But I appreciated that you brought up the Gates Foundation, because they've taken this from such a different approach. They're saying, what's the bang for the buck? If we have X amount of dollars, put your best and brightest out there and tell us how many lives can we save.
Right.
And then they have that second dimension and no one else is doing it yet. And they've been very efficient. It's almost a whole other approach to, you know, where can we do this. So I want to ask you one thing, Terrell. Francesco said, you know, well, what we should be looking for is where can we induce the greatest change in practice. And you have done a lot on identifying where the greatest change in practice has been. Looking at, do you think that's the goal? Where can we create the greatest change?
Well, I think it's also where does the greatest change need to happen?
Mm-hmm. How do you find that?
Where's the biggest difference between what the ideal would be and what current practices are?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the outcomes, the loss of potential outcomes associated with that?
So that would be a lot of modeling for potential impact of change.
Right.
And I think a lot of what's guiding the whole CER is, you know, the IOM's list of, what, 100 things that are important. They're going to tick off the list. I was wondering when you asked the question on, is dentistry in that
list? That's what I was partly
list?
Asking, too.
There's one.
There is one?
One
of the 100?
Right.
Uh-huh. Well, that's the one to keep an eye on.
So we were
and
both happy and angry at the same time.
Yeah.
Happy to have one.
One.
Why only one? But
and
I think increasingly we realize the fact that a lot of the oral biology and medicine
yeah.
issues have systemic
yeah.
Consequences. So we still can tap into that,
mm-hmm.
You know, that area through an indirect funnel.
And I guess what we're all also hoping is that, you know, PCORI will begin to set an agenda that isn't just an agenda that already exists. And maybe we can help them do that.
I would hope that UCLA could help move
some
agenda.
Yeah. Thank you very much.